Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
He kōna i purangi tēnei nā te reo irirangi o Aotearoa.
Kia ora, nō mai haramai ki te auhurahanga. Hello and welcome to Our Changing World, ko Clack and Cannon tēnei. We're taking a pause on Voice of Tangaroa this week to bring you some Godwit news. If you want to listen to the latest episode in that series, you can find it online. But today, we head to the Motueka Sandspit, near the top of the South Island. In October 2023, spring here in New Zealand, Alison Balance joined a team of wading bird experts there. They were on a mission to catch eastern bar-tailed godwits. Back then, the birds were newly arrived from Alaska. But now, after a summer feeding on rich intertidal mudflats, the godwits are leaving, heading back to their Alaskan breeding grounds. Some of them are carrying tiny high-tech tracking devices, which the scientists hope will shed more light on the lives and journeys of these remarkable long-haul champions.
We've arrived at low tide on a long sandy spit on the edge of a very large estuary. Somewhere out there on the mudflats are thousands of godwits. The tidal clock is ticking, and in a few hours' time, rising water will force the birds to retreat to higher ground, where we'll be waiting. Shorebirds like godwits have been a lifelong passion for expert David Melville, who's one of the leaders for today's mission.
Good morning, David.
Good morning, Alison.
It's just after dawn on a very crisp morning on the Motueka Sandspit, and what is the plan for today?
So we're hoping to catch some bar-tailed godwits. It's going to be high tide at 10:51, so we've got to make sure that we've got everything sorted and out of the way well before then, at least a couple of hours ahead.
What have you got laid out along the beach here?
So we've got what we call a cannon net, which is a fine mesh net which we aim to fire over the flock of roosting birds. The fine mesh means that we can get the birds out very quickly. They're not getting entangled in it at all. They're just down under the net. And this is why we want the birds concentrated at a high tide roost, so that we have a better opportunity of catching some.
David and some other Kiwi cannon netting experts are here to help an international team of researchers. It's all hands on deck to get the nets and the cannons in place and camouflaged so that, hopefully, the birds will be unaware of them.
What are you up to there, Willie?
Switching the ropes onto the projectile so that when it goes bang, it takes out the net with it.
So there's cables everywhere and chocolate blocks.
Yep, and it's the wiring up so that when the fuse goes, the mortars fire and send the net out over the birds.
So how many birds were out here yesterday?
It's probably about 1,200. Today we're expecting probably another 1,000 more, because on the higher tide they'll get pushed out of the Waimea Inlet, and this is the only other place the birds can come to. Once we finish setting the nets, everybody will withdraw from the area, we'll let the birds come in, and hope that the tide and the birds do the right thing so that we can actually fire the net and catch some.
Eastern bar-tailed godwits spend up to 6 months every year in Australasia. After spending the summer fattening up in the southern hemisphere, the godwits fly north in March. They follow a route known as the East Asian-Australasian Flyway, which takes them to Arctic Alaska via the Yellow Sea. From New Zealand, they take 7 or 8 days to cover the 10,000 or so kilometres to reach large areas of tidal mudflats in China, Taiwan and Korea. They feed here for 4 to 6 weeks before moving on to the Alaskan tundra, where they breed. In September and October, they return south, and it's these journeys that have catapulted the godwits into the record books. They make the longest non-stop migration of any bird. We know this because by the mid-2000s, satellite trackers had got small enough to be used on godwits, and in 2007, a female known as E7 set the first record. 11,680 kilometres of non-stop flight. With no stops for food or rest, she flew for more than 8 days over open ocean from Alaska to New Zealand. E7's epic migration has been eclipsed since then by the 13,560 kilometre non-stop journey made by bird B6 in 2022. B6 was tagged as a juvenile in Alaska and was just 5 months old when it made its first ever 11-day flight to Tasmania. Anyway, back to the Motueka sandspit. Jessie Conklin has been studying New Zealand godwits since 2007, the year of E7's remarkable flight, when he embarked on a PhD here. He was studying the timing of godwit migrations between New Zealand and Alaska.
We found that individuals have very specific schedules, and that was linked to basically geography in Alaska, which is interesting. So the timing of things that happen in New Zealand is actually based on where a godwit breeds in Alaska on a latitudinal cline, which is interesting. So the whole annual cycle is shifted by about three or four weeks from the southernmost birds to the northernmost birds in Alaska.
So that's they need to wait for snow to melt and things to get warm enough and the
exactly
insects.
Exactly, it's all based on the timing of when they want to nest in Alaska. So like godwits leave New Zealand across about a 1 month period, the entire month of March, and the ones that leave at the beginning of March or the end of February even these days will be the ones that breed in southern Alaska, and the ones that leave more like the 25th of March or so, and even into April, those are the ones that breed all the way on the north slope of Alaska.
Jesse completed his PhD, but COVID pandemic aside, has returned to New Zealand every year since to carry on studying the godwits.
No matter what you study, if you study it long enough, you learn something that you weren't expecting to. During my PhD, because a PhD is only 3 or 4 years, you get a certain impression. And the impression that we got was that timing was static. If a bird left on March 18th this year, it would keep leaving around, you know, between the 17th and the 20th every year. And then when I started having more than 10 years of data, I found that all of them were shifting earlier. So individual differences stayed, but the whole population was moving earlier. So after 13 years of data, I showed that the whole population had moved its migration date from New Zealand by about 5 days across that period.
Is this a climate change related thing?
It's very interesting because that would be the assumption that as the Arctic is warming and phenology up there is getting earlier, they basically nest as soon as the snowmelt will allow them to. As soon as the tundra is open, they'll start breeding. And also this is linked to timing of insects and other things that they need to eat up there. So, yeah, the prediction is that as the snow melt gets earlier, then they would need to breed earlier. So they should be responding. There's been a lot of talk in the bird migration world about whether they can, whether they have the right signals, for instance, like how would they know and do they need to remember? Is it only long-lived birds that could do this, that kind of thing? So I did an analysis basically trying to link this change in departure with the change in phenology in Alaska. And what's interesting is we had, first of all, the predictions are not clear because different parts of Alaska have changed differently. But in general, we know that in general, Arctic's springs are getting earlier. But we had a number of birds tagged on their, we used to use geolocators, we're now using more satellite telemetry. We deployed a bunch of these in 2008 and 2009, and then also in 2014 and 2015. And so we had these two cohorts that we could compare. And the interesting thing we found through that, we found that they were not getting to Alaska earlier. So the whole population was leaving New Zealand earlier, but they were not getting to Alaska earlier.
So where were they spending that extra time?
In the Yellow Sea. So this led to a couple of hypotheses. One is maybe they don't mean to get to Alaska earlier. Maybe they don't know they should get to Alaska earlier. But the other one is maybe they can't. And so this is the hypothesis that I favor at the moment, because we know the conditions in the Yellow Sea where they spend about 4 to 6 weeks on their way up to Alaska. The conditions there have gotten worse and worse over the years because of reclamation and pollution and everything. So there's a lot of data showing that food resources for these kind of birds that are going through the Yellow Sea, and there's millions of them going through the Yellow Sea, not just godwits, have generally been deteriorating. So
that all-purpose buffet is just not as good as it used to be.
That's a working hypothesis, is that they're actually not able to fatten up as quickly or as well as they want to. And so even though they leave here early enough to respond. Yeah, that's a bunch of godwits over there. so it could be that they're limited in their ability to get fat enough over there.
In 2019, Jesse joined forces with avian researcher Bart Kempenaars from the Max Planck Institute for Biological Intelligence in Germany. They began another study, this time focused on juvenile godwits.
If you catch an adult bird and you put a band on it, it's going to keep coming back to that place until it dies. And that it's basically 100% that if
so
the
they're
bird...
They're very loyal to their
sites, at least at some scale. Like at Foxton, I've been following individual birds, like I said, since 2007, 2006. And so they just keep coming back. But if you catch a juvenile and put a band on it, you're 90% likely to never see it again. And you could say maybe they die, but that's not what's going on. It's because juveniles move. So you think of a juvenile, it's born in Alaska, hatched, and then it flies south when it's about 4 months old, makes the longest flight known in birds when it's 4 months old, lands in New Zealand, and then roams around and finds a place that it's going to call home as an adult. When does this happen and why does it happen? And we know that generally birds skip two northbound migrations before they become a migrating adult. But this also varies. Some of them skip one, some of them skip two, some of them skip three. And so we became very fascinated so how does this settling process happen? When I got Bart Kempenaars from Max Planck involved, it was on the idea of we should start trying to track juveniles as soon as they arrive in New Zealand. So our pilot study in 2019, we targeted juveniles and put a bunch of satellite tags on juveniles. And I can't even list the things that they've done. They have done every possible thing you could imagine. And we're still compiling these data and waiting for some of these birds to show us how they become an adult.
In the meantime, we're waiting for the tide to come in.
Yeah.
You must have watched a lot of tides come and go.
Yep.
Now, the reason the shorebird experts are all gathered here at the Motueka Sandspit, where the tide is still coming in, is another collaboration between Jesse and Bart.
You know, one of the most amazing things about the godwit, as everybody knows, is when they come from Alaska, they fly to New Zealand non-stop. And it's the longest non-stop flight that we know about. It takes, say, 9 days or so. And then the question is, of course, you know, during this flight, how can they do this? Don't they have to sleep? Because all animals need to sleep. Sleep is essential. If you sleep deprive an animal, it ultimately dies. So how can they do this? And there are two possibilities. Either they have evolved a mechanism by which they can forego sleep for this period, which would be amazing, or they have found a way to sleep during this flight. And this is, of course, also hard to imagine because they have flapping flight. We expected it would be continuous flapping flight. They can't soar or like fly like seabirds. And then it's hard to imagine that they could really sleep during this flapping flight. So one idea is to use tags that tell us how high these birds fly. And then the idea would be that they would, you know, increase their altitude and then have a period in which they can glide down. And during this slow gliding phase, one can imagine that they could sleep. Birds can sleep with one side of the brain and have the other side awake. But if it's gliding flight, horizontal gliding flight, one can even imagine that they could sleep with both sides of the brain. And the other thing we know about birds is that their sleep phases can be like very short. So in the pectoral sandpiper, we measured sleep in the brain with electrodes in free living males. And the longest sleep bout is 35 seconds or something.
Wow, talk about power naps.
Yes, exactly. Yes. Exactly. So they make power naps, and in the Arctic it's 24-hour daylight and they're competing and so on. So we knew that they are active a lot, and if you add up all the sleep, these short sleep bouts, you get to something like 2, 3, 4 hours of sleep. So they do this a lot, but only short times. So it is feasible, based on that work, that the Godwits have this kind of gliding phase, and during this gliding phase they could have short sleep bouts. And maybe the sleep then is very intense. This is also one of the mysteries, of course. We still don't exactly know what sleep is about. There are many hypotheses. You know, it is kind of conceivable that they can, in these gliding phases, through short sleep outs, accumulate enough sleep to solve the problems in the brain. And with the tags, what we hope is that we can kind of see these, or not, these altitudinal changes, and then estimate what proportion of this entire journey could they make these gliding flights.
Now, this sleep project involves avian sleep expert Niels Ruttenberg, also from the Max Planck Institute for Biological Intelligence. One of Niels' earlier projects involved studying chinstrap penguins while they were at the nest incubating eggs. The penguins were fitted with very high-tech tags which used EEG to measure brainwaves directly. It turned out that the penguins are masters of the power nap. Each day they had thousands of microsleeps, each lasting just 1 to 5 seconds. Usually just one side of the brain took a micro-nap, so the other side could stay alert for danger. But over the course of 24 hours, these tiny sleeps accumulated to nearly 12 hours of sleep. But what about birds that aren't lying down? Neil's team used the same EEG tags on frigate birds. Tropical frigate birds are large and have long wings, and they are experts at locking their wings so they can glide effortlessly. They spend many days or even weeks at a time out at sea hunting for food, and, like the godwit, they can't land on water to rest. It turns out they grab shut-eye around sunset, when they are high up, circling on thermals of rising warm air. They lock their wings, and one side of their brain goes to sleep for up to 6 minutes at a time, while the other side stays alert to make sure they don't crash into another snoozing frigate bird. 40 minutes to an hour a day is enough to keep them going while they're at sea, and when they're back at the nest, they catch up on lost sleep. Now, godwits are too small to use the fancy EEG tags, so Bart and colleagues have thought of another way to measure sleep deprivation in godwits, which, unlike those soaring frigate birds, have to flap their wings continuously to stay aloft.
Ultimately, what we want for the sleep study is variation in how long the journey is. If this bird would really have a period where it was sleep deprived for a long time, then what you'd expect is when it arrives here in New Zealand that it needs to have what is called catch-up sleep. And so these tags also automatically measure activity. And so we don't know whether they sleep, but we know whether they rest or whether they're active. And the longer the journey has taken, the longer this period of rest after arriving should be. That's our prediction.
And so step one, catch the birds.
That's right.
Yep, we are still waiting for the tide to come in before we can fire the cannon nets, which gives me a chance to chat with Mihai Valku about the new generation of tags that will be fitted to the godwits. These are tags that will phone home instead of sending data via satellite.
In front of us on the sand, looking like they're getting some sun on them, are the transmitters you're going to attach to the godwits, assuming we manage to catch some. Can you explain to me what they're capable of doing?
Sure. Those are really high-tech, tiny radio devices. What's inside, it's actually would be an equivalent of a mobile phone, a GPS, and a couple of other sensors, and they are all packed together in a device that it's probably 4.5 grams, and it's all operated by the solar panel.
So this sits on the back of the godwit, It catches the sun all the time, and particularly when they go to Alaska, they've got 24-hour daylight, so there's lots of charging for them.
Exactly. Also, when they fly, they get exposed pretty well to the sun, and they charge very well.
And so what's it going to allow you to record?
So we're going to record a couple of parameters. We're going to record position, so latitude and longitude, through the GPS. We're going to record several environmental variables, temperature or barometric pressure as well. We're also going to record activity, and this is the most interesting part here. The activity is measured based on accelerometry. So when the bird moves in the three directions, so up and down, left, right, and so on, then something is recorded there. There is lots of data processing on the bird, and this data processing is going to be translated into one parameter that will tell us how active the bird is. Potentially, we will know if they fly with flapping flight or they're going to glide.
How many transmitters have you got?
There are 45 here charging at the moment, and we hope we deploy as many as we can.
So you got your spotting scope out, Jesse, and are watching the birds down the beach.
Yeah, because there's always some marked birds. But I knew that I was looking for a particular bird, and I just found her. In 2019, when we tagged a bunch of juveniles just to see where they went, one night at the Ohau Estuary, south of the Manawatu, we put out a few tags, and one juvenile female got a satellite tag. And this bird did her roaming around New Zealand like we expected, but then ended up at the Motueka Estuary at some point. And she just got back here on the 26th of October, we know from the satellite tracking. So we were checking for her yesterday but didn't find her, but I just found her. She's just in the flock over here that's approaching.
Oh,
so
nice.
So this is exactly what we were trying to find out. So she is now an adult and has made two full round trips from Alaska from her new home at Motueka, even though we banded her at the Ohau Estuary in 2019.
On future trips, you'll be able to look out for her again and yep. again yep. and again.
Yeah, exactly. Yep. We know how old this one is, so that's the key.
The tide and the godwits are getting close, which just gives me time for a brief chat with Janelle Wieranga, a vet who is a postdoctoral fellow at Otago and Massey Universities.
So we are doing some what we call swab sampling from the godwits. So being that they're migratory birds, it's quite important to know what kind of viruses or other potential organisms that are normal for them to have. And we want to be able to have a good idea of just kind of a surveillance perspective on what's normal for these birds so that when abnormal happens, which it tends to from time to time, we'll be able to identify that a little bit quicker, hopefully.
So one of the viruses that's very much in the news at the moment is avian flu.
Yes.
So that's the kind of thing that's on your radar?
It is definitely something we can find in what we get from the sampling. So if there is avian influenza present, it will be more likely that we will find it, even if it has changed quite a bit too. And that gives us a little bit better evaluation too of how these viruses change over time and space, which is quite important.
Okay, I think we should go for a catch while we've got a chance.
The tide and the birds are finally aligned.
Okay, safety area is clear. 3, 2, 1, fire.
It's a successful catch. Everyone races down the beach to get the godwits into a dark, cool box. Now everyone is focused on quietly and quickly processing the birds. They're measured, weighed, given a unique numbered leg band and a large leg flag so they can be easily identified through binoculars, and finally fitted with a smart tag.
And the bill length is 115.
115?
Yeah.
So what's your job here, Rob?
Doing biometrics of the birds. They just arrived, they are very lean in weight, and now they're starting with their molt. So they arrive in October and they depart somewhere in March, so there's around 6 months. And in the time, the first 3 months, all the energy that they take from the tidal flats here that are so important is basically allocated for changing their feathers. So the feathers that they grow now are effectively the feathers that will end up in Alaska and come back to New Zealand again. And that's 28 to 32,000 kilometers, all with these brand new feathers over here. It is amazing.
It's astounding, isn't it?
Yeah.
It is.
Yeah.
Great. And then that bird will get passed to the next station, which is you, Janelle, doing
the oral and cloacal swab station.
I bet they're going to look forward to that. So looking for viruses.
So I just open the beak, and then we'll just put the swab just near the tongue, and the birds don't mind that at all. So then just inserting the swab into the cloacal, and then it's out within less than 2 seconds.
Great, and then the bird moves along the conveyor belt. You've had a busy afternoon, Jesse.
Yes, we take a bird and we get a small blood sample. We know that from a bird's weight and size, basically what size a harness. And so by the time we're done with the blood sample, Mihai has made a harness of that size. And then they fit it. We test the unit to make sure that it's transmitting. And then we record the right unit number for each bird. And then we get a portrait photograph of it. And then it's released into the wind. Yeah.
45 bar-tailed godwits will soon be leaving on their annual trip to Alaska, carrying a solar phone transmitter. If they stop over en route in China, where there is a 5G mobile network, they will hopefully transmit some data. If they're in North Korea, however, they won't be able to, as there is no phone network. They'll also be out of phone range in Alaska. So the researchers will be waiting with bated breath until later this year, when the tagged birds arrive back in New Zealand and phone home with their precious data.
Big thanks to Jesse Conklin, Bart Kempeneers and Mihai Valku from the Max Planck Institute for Biological Intelligence. And to Janelle Wieringer from Otago and Massey Universities. Thanks also to the Motueka Spit Godwit team, especially David Melville and Rob Schuchard. This story was produced and presented by Alison Balance, and sound engineering was by William Saunders. Extra production help was by Ellen Rikers, and Tim Watkin is executive producer of podcasts and series at RNZ. Our webpage is at rnz.co.nz/ourchangingworld, where you can sign up to our monthly newsletter. And if you've got feedback for us, you can email ourchangingworld@rnz.co.nz. Te nā koe I whakarongo mai. Thanks so much for listening. Ko Clark and Kanana ho. Have a great week. Kia pai, te wiki.
Okay, I have two new obsessions that I need to share with you. Impress No Glue Press-On Manis and Impress Press-On Falsies Lashes. Trust me, these are getting ready game changers. Both require no glue, so there is no damage to your natural nails and lashes, no mess, and no annoying dry times. Just one step and you're done. Boom. Instant glam. Visit impressbeauty.com/presson and use code PRESSON25 at checkout for 25% off Impress manicure and Press-On falsies.